Paul Krugman is the Distinguished Professor of Economics at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. He was the recipient of the 2008 Nobel Prize in Economics. This past Sunday, after a screening of the Academy Award-winning 1976 film All the President's Men, Krugman joined Alan Chartok at the Mehewi in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, as part of the Berkshire International Film Festival for a conversation about current events and the Trump administration. We share their discussion with you now.
I have a question for you. What's going on?
We're all doomed. What else to say?
Do you see any parallels at all between what we just...
Yes and no. I mean, right? I mean, obviously, I think what we already know, what's out in the, you know, we don't need Deep Throat now, although we're going to have some, we hope, some pretty interesting testimony and investigations coming along if they're not blocked. But what's already known, if our political constellation, if Congress today was like Congress was in the mid-1970s, we would have impeached this guy already. Right? I mean, and of course, lots of parallels. You know, it's what we learned from Watergate was that it is possible for the President of the United States to turn out to be a really bad guy. And that was worth remembering. It was always something that could happen again. But obviously, lots and lots of parallels now. But we're a very, very different country in many ways, not in a good way.
Could you go into that just a little bit, what the differences are now and then?
Yeah, so in many ways, I mean, America's a better place than it was. We're much less racist. There's still plenty of racism, but much less than there was. We're much more open. We're culturally much more diverse. We have, the coffee is inconceivably better. But in the 1970s, there was a genuine political center. There was a genuine community. It was possible to imagine that senators of goodwill would come together and say, this cannot go on. I was actually doing a little homework to think about the fact that when the Watergate hearings were underway, the Republican senator from New York was Jacob Javits, who was an actual Republican liberal, you know, not less conservative than his colleagues, but an actual liberal. That just doesn't happen anymore. These days, the leftmost Republican in Congress is well to the right of the rightmost Democrat. The complete partisan divide, which means there is no center, there's no cooperation, and it's almost inconceivable that simply the facts of the case or justice would lead this Congress to decide that any Republican president needs to go.
Will it come to a point when and I've thought this a long time, when the Republicans see Trump's numbers going so low that they have to say it's me or him?
That's right. What will eventually do it is not justice, not what's happening, not abuse of power is too much, you know, sticks in their craw, because I don't think they have craws anymore. It'll be polling and by-elections that suggest a tidal wave if they don't get rid of this guy. It'll be the prospects of the 2018 midterms or the results of the 2018 midterms with a change of control in Congress or nothing.
What about this 38%? That's the interesting thing. They don't seem to have moved. There was an analysis in your newspaper, the New York Times, which basically said they attempted to show that, yeah, the same 38% was there, but the enthusiasm was lower on the 38%.
Yeah, this is popular, you know, approval ratings. And it's been hovering at around, you know, 38 to 40%. After, you know, Trump came into office slightly negative, it dropped rapidly, and since then it's fluctuated, which is extraordinarily poor. And what's also unusual is that there's a solid, you know, 50-something, 55% disapproval. But you say, well, why doesn't it go lower? Those of us who follow the news, follow politics obsessively, do need to bear in mind that, you know, most people don't. Most people, they pick up stuff. If they voted for Trump they'd have some vague sense that maybe some bad stuff's going on, but maybe it's just those liberals are stirring stuff up, and it hasn't really struck home. And until they start to see that it really is hurting their daily lives, they won't turn against. But look, this is already, I mean, we were already at a range that if the midterm elections were held today, Democrats would probably, not by certainly, but probably would take the House. So this is, you don't want to say, look, this guy still has solid popularity. He doesn't.
And you're such a world-renowned economist, but you've been writing about Medicaid and the Trump bill and, you know, the health care bill. What the hell's wrong with him?
When I say, you know, people don't pay attention to politics or the details of policy, in this case, in terms of not paying attention to the details or actually knowing anything at all about policy, you'd have to include the President of the United States in that category now. Some of his comments when he talks about healthcare, other issues too, but on healthcare, a bunch of us wonky types, you know, follow that one, particularly because it happens to be a very clear subject. I mean, it's grateful in the sense that the analysis works. Often he'll make comments which suggest that he has absolutely no idea what's in his own health bill, that he has no idea how the system we have now works. So that if you ask why is Trump planning to do things that will inevitably cause, there's not really much dispute about the numbers. You know, CBO says 23 million people will lose insurance. It could be 18, it could be 28, but it's got to be in that vicinity. And that's just obvious. But Trump doesn't know that. He probably doesn't even realize that. I mean, he has actually said a couple of days ago, we need to be spending more money on healthcare. And I was like, but your own bill is taking $800 billion away to give tax cuts to rich people. But he probably doesn't know that.
He talked about how he loved, during the campaign, he loved the undereducated. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, partly just mouthing off, but it's true. Education was a strong predictor of the vote. Although, I want to say there's a little bit of a funny thing. I mean, this when you come back to this whole issue of partisanship and extreme views, and you know, now we're thinking about things like climate change. If you say, well, people who are better educated are going to not fall for the nonsense, that's actually not as true as we would like. In terms of, in this highly partisan era, there have been some studies that show that when a party holds factually wrong beliefs, when there are party positions, like the position that global warming is a hoax, that actually partisans of that party are more likely to agree with the false positions if they're better educated. Because poorly educated Republicans don't know what Republicans are supposed to believe, whereas well-educated Republicans do. And so the false beliefs are actually stronger among the people who have had more education. So it's not just a case of people, if only they'd more of them had gone to college. It's true that if more Americans had gone to college, the our politics would, in the current environment, shift somewhat left. But it's not as happy a story as we'd like, because in some cases it turns out that education just helps you to do a better job of rationalizing your prejudices.
For those listening,
boy, I'm a real ray of sunshine tonight.
For those listening to this on the radio on WAMC, I just want you to know we're talking with Paul Krugman, and we're delighted to have you here. I wanted to ask you this, and that is, tell us about the Russians.
Look, I don't know anything except what's being reported. Although what's kind of funny was it was pretty obvious the existence of some kind of odd affinity between Trump and Putin was obvious, you know, last summer. You didn't have to be doing, you didn't have to be getting revelations. I mean, there's much more stuff has come out now, but it was already. I wrote a piece called The Siberian Candidate, and that's from June of last year. So it was already obvious that there was something funny. Now, exactly what's going on here, we don't know. Is it financial? As we learn more, are there debts? Is there a financial deal? I think we probably want to be starting to talk increasingly not just about Trump personally, but about his family. It looks like there may be some really interesting stuff involving Jared Kushner. Who knows? Or is it, how much of it is just a kind of natural affinity towards authoritarian strongmen? Because Trump has had nice things to say about Erdogan in Turkey, who is actually an Islamist strongman. He's had nice things to say about Duterte in the Philippines, who is, I don't know, but anyway, you know, likes to kill people. Al-Sisi. So what is clear, however, is that Trump is more comfortable with authoritarian strongmen. And in the case of Putin, it's an authoritarian strongman who has a coterie of oligarchs who do appear to have a lot of interesting business connections with people who in turn are close to Trump. There's some stuff in there that's very weird, but you know, as there's a joke, one of people says, the Russians are, you know, they can blackmail him because they have a tape of him boasting about sexually assaulting women. Except that actually, you know, we all heard that, and so that's the end, you know, the conversation on TV. So what exactly they could have on him personally that isn't something we already know isn't at all clear.
We saw this movie just now, and the FBI, we now know who the Deep Throat was, and was right. The deputy director of the FBI. So I'm going to ask you a question. Here's the question. It's very long. Comey.
It's starting to look, as somebody said, few people in American history have played themselves as badly as he did. In an attempt to bend over backwards, not to to annoy Republicans, he behaved abominably during the campaign. Not only, you know, revealed, talked about ongoing investigations, he gave lectures, he essentially intervened quite heavily in a pro-Republican way. Crucially, I think, it's pretty much open and shut that without that last Comey letter, we would have had a narrow victory by Hillary Clinton. And yet, it turns out that he apparently didn't think that could happen. He just assumed that Trump wasn't going to win. So he was just trying to, you know, soften up his relations with the Republicans. And then very quickly said, okay, well, now I have to actually start doing my job, and immediately got fired.
And that was Nixonian, too.
Yeah, and you know, people act as if, well, if you are a liberal and you think that Comey did terrible things, shouldn't you be glad that he was fired? The answer is no. It's one thing, you know, to say that he did a terrible thing, but to have him, you know, fired as what is clearly an attempt at obstruction of justice is something entirely different. You know, if he was going to be, you know, fired and replaced with somebody we all trusted, but that ain't going to happen.
As long as you've raised Hillary Clinton, let's talk about Hillary a little bit. There's this famous interview that's now out in which she talks about why she lost. And I know you were enthusiastic about her. What do you think?
You know, I don't think we really fully understand what went on. I mean, there were mistakes in the campaign, but there are mistakes in every campaign. There was incredible hostility from the media. We can quantify this. We can certainly quantify it for network news, where we know that there was three times as much coverage of the emails. And remember, there is no email scandal. She had a private server. Nothing happened as a result of it. She wasn't the first Secretary of State to have a private server. This was a completely invented scandal. There was three times as much coverage on TV of the emails as there was of all policy issues combined. Think about that. And so the media was intensely hostile. Why exactly, I still haven't fully figured out, because I didn't, you know, feel that at all. And then, who knows, misogyny, something about tone, it's just hard to know quite what happened. But the real thing I think we should be asking is why, you know, she's not running again.
Are you sure?
Yes, not going to be running for president. I would say to any opinion writer, any news analyst who is spending time now writing about the flaws of Hillary Clinton, you know, what the hell is wrong with you? Get a life. There is, you know, the fate of the world is at stake.
You, of course, are a great economist. I have a question for you about that. You look at the budget, and you look at how the United States reacts to or is involved with the whole world. And that, of course, is why you won a Nobel Prize in so many ways. You know, you you understood how it all works. So tell us, you got a budget coming out now. What do you make of it? What do you make of the way in which, what are we doing in worldwide?
Okay, so the thing about, look, first of all, to say we have a budget is kind of an insult to, you know, the meaning of the word. It's something that's written down. It's really basically a page of talking points. And I mean, there's some innovations. I mean, inventing trillions of dollars of imaginary revenues and savings, that's been done. But this is the first one that has a $2 trillion, you know, pulling money out of thin air and then counts it twice. Rich countries, rich, advanced, stable countries, when we are still a rich country and we, you know, are advanced, and, well, I guess we're going to find out about this ability, but as long as they're perceived as being politically stable, have enormous leeway fiscally to do stuff that's wrong. Japan, which I've studied a lot, partly because I, looking in the 90s, I saw Japan's woes as a potential precursor to something similar here, which unfortunately turned out to be true. But Japan has run up enormous debts. Their debts are well over 200% of GDP, you know, well over twice as high relative to the economy as ours. And people who keep on betting that, well, at some point they won't be able to sell their bonds and people are going to, they're going to have a crisis. That trade, shorting Japanese bonds, has come to be known as the widowmaker, because everybody who's made that trade has lost money. Rich, advanced countries that borrow in their own currency can go a very long way with big debts, big deficits. There's nothing immediately crisis-making about the budget. It's dishonest, it's irresponsible, and it's also completely lacking in substantive detail. But a country like the United States can ride, actually Adam Smith, one of his famous quotes among my people anyway, is he said, there's a great deal of ruin in a nation. It takes a lot of mismanagement to screw up a country like the United States.
There's a famous Yale historian who thinks that his looking at history shows that we're going towards it's the end of democracy, maybe oligarchy, maybe fascism, maybe dictatorship. What do you think?
I worry about it. I mean, it's a funny thing. I mean, that certainly can happen. I mean, we talk about our system, we talk about checks and balances, but all of those checks and balances they have to be enforced by people. And if you have a situation in which a majority of Congress is unwilling, you know, our presidency is a little bit like an elective dictatorship. It's about a lot of power placed in the hands of one man. And really, the only real restraint comes from Congress. And if you have a Congress that, because of extreme partisanship, is never going to do that, then you worry. And we have seen countries with nominally democratic institutions slide into authoritarianism. That's actually happening in Turkey and Hungary right now. Now, I have to say, I was more frightened, I mean, I'm still frightened of that prospect, but I'm less frightened about it now than I was on Inauguration Day, because so far, the great phrase from one of the Lawfare blog, malevolence tempered by incompetence. So far, you're not making as much headway in demolishing our institutions as you might have feared. But of course, there's nothing, you know, we have no God-given guarantee of maintaining a democratic system.
Let's go back to your phenomenal expertise, Paul, in the way in which the rest of the world will react economically to us. We have the EU. What do you expect to happen?
What we don't know, I mean, so far, when it comes to actual confrontations on trade, I mean, to the extent there was a real message in Trump's campaign economically was, I'm going to get tough on the Mexicans, going to get tough on the Chinese. So far, on all of the substantive trade issues, he's wimped out. He did not declare China a currency manipulator, which it's not. It was 5 years ago, but it isn't now. But he didn't decide to go ahead with it anyway. If you want to look, there was a lot of great deal of concern. You know, the Mexican peso plunged with the election. It's now back up to where it was because of the Mexican, you know, people who are making decisions about investments in Mexico have concluded that Trump is all huff and puff and no reality to his threats. Europeans, we don't know yet. So, I mean, it's one thing to, pulling out of Paris Accord is a terrible signal for the future of any kind of international agreements. But substantively, there hasn't been, the protectionism that was so much part of this campaign isn't something he's actually done.
You mentioned the Paris Accords. How dangerous?
Climate change, and you know, at some level, if we don't deal with it, then nothing else matters. The science is clear enough. In fact, most of the risk of being wrong, well, the risks are very asymmetric. It's possible, although it's looking increasingly unlikely, that there'll be less global warming than the models suggest. It's also possible there'll be more. And of course, if we act and it turns out that it was an exaggerated threat, we've spent a little money. And if we don't act and turns out to be worse than we expect, then it's the end of the world, basically. So that should be the overwhelming issue. By announcing that we're out of the of Paris, Trump actually, there's not a lot of substance to that immediately. In fact, we wouldn't have exited until it turns out just after Election Day 2020, as I understand the timing. So there will be questions. There are investments, clean energy investments, that people might say, well, I'm not going to make because the U.S. is not going to have a climate policy. It's not irreparable, I don't think, but it can literally swamp all other issues as rising seas undo us all in.
Paul, when we're all sitting here having just seen the wonderful, all the president's men, my question to you is this. 10 years from now, when the Trump administration is undergoing a similar film,
oh my
what
God.
Do you expect to see in it?
I would hate to be in charge of script writing for that film because all the president's men, there was the Watergate, there was a pretty straightforward, there was one thread to the scandal. There was the plumbers and there was Nixon and doing his thing and there were, and the, now it's like this enormous spider web of scandal. There are threads coming in from all directions. Is it about the Russian connection? Is it about the Turks? Is it about Flynn? Is it about Kushner? Is it about the massive self-dealing, the exploitation of the presidency for personal financial gain? You know, that in itself would not long ago have been considered an obvious impeachment offense.
I want to go to that.
But so I think it would be, I can't even, the plot is almost impossible to lay out here. It's just too complex, and also it's just fundamentally implausible. This can't really be happening.
Do you ever think that when you wake up in the morning?
Oh,
how
quite
the hell
often.
Is this happening?
Yeah.
How did this happen?
Yeah, well, and all of it. I mean, there's this combination of scariness and it's sort of like the evil clown genre of movie turned into real life, right? It's we now know if a major incident happens in a foreign country, what we know is that the president will tweet something that insults and attacks and demeans a major ally and then go golfing.
But this thing you just mentioned, the idea of the potential that there's personal avarice, the Trump line of clothing, Ivanka's clothing, or the kid who comes out and says, oh yeah, you know, the Russians have been giving us money for our golf course for years, yeah. And then takes it back after they obviously get on him. Is it possible that the presidency is being sold?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, one of the puzzles, I read political scientists. I'm not one, but I take their stuff seriously. And one of the puzzles, actually, believe it or not, is how little money there is in politics. Even though, yes, we spend billions on elections, given the ability of the U.S. government to make decisions that throw hundreds of billions, even trillions of dollars in the direction of people it favors, The incentives to bribe are enormous, and we've relied upon basically an outrage constraint to keep that from happening. If you have a situation where no one, where a solid majority in Congress is held by people who are not going to enforce that constraint, then sure. And it can be done, you know, very, very, since there's been no divestment of the business empire, you know, all you have to do is hold lots of luxury events at Trump properties, have your, and also, actually, especially dealing with the Russians. If Russia were the old Soviet Union, then that would be one thing. But given that what it is, which is an oligarchy in which money is never going to come directly from Putin to a Trump family member, it's always going to involve some oligarch who, just out of the goodness of his heart, makes this incredibly sweet deal. You know, so it's all going to be deniable. So sure, why would we think that it can't happen here?
When you go to a doctor's office, they say, and your back hurts, they say, how much pain do you have, 1 to 10? You say 7 or 6. What's your number?
Oh, look, we're teetering quite close to the edge here. I mean, if you had asked me, again, if you asked me on Inauguration Day, what were the chances of, you know, U.S. democracy still being around in any recognizable form 4 years from now, I would have probably put it at 50% or less. I would now put it much higher, because it's turned out that there's much more political resistance, there's much more just, there are a lot of good people in the country, and there's a lot more activism. When I was still at Princeton, I had an office neighbor who was working on the devolution of Hungarian democracy. So I was actually, through her, I was following that, even though obviously I don't know anything about Hungary. And but what you saw from that was that, you know, part of it was the demoralization. The opposition just sort of felt defeated and was giving up. And that has not been happening.
That was Alan Chartok speaking with New York Times op-ed columnist and economist Paul Krugman at the Mahewy in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, as part of the Berkshire International Film Festival. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.